This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about some real-life stories like The 33 and My All-American, also Labyrinth of Lies, which is also a true story, and then the non-true stories, Love the Coopers and The Funhouse Massacre. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and, of course, the world-famous home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Also on Instagram at fatguysatthemovies. But if you want to find me on Twitter, you got to find me at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thanks, Ron Burgundy. Let's roll into the news. First of all, a rest in peace to Gunnar Hansen. He is best known for being the first person to play Leatherface in the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, obviously you never saw his face, but I mean, he was an imposing fellow, and everything I've heard about him is he was just a sweetheart off camera. Apparently he was the nicest guy you could ever work with, great personality. And for those who would go see him, because he spent a lot of time, especially recently, at conventions and places like Horror Hound, he was always easy to deal with and very warm and personable, very different than Leatherface. He wasn't chopping anybody up with a chainsaw. So he had died of cancer this week at age 68. The next piece of news is Neil Blomkamp is bowing out of Alien 5 in order to possibly do the time travel thriller The Gone World. And that's cool. I'm all for directors doing what they need to do to go, because apparently Prometheus 2 has been fast-tracked by Fox, which is putting Alien 5 on the back burner. I was waiting for those things to butt up against each other, because you cannot have two people who want to define the franchise be fighting against each other like this. And already Alien 5 was going to have some issues because apparently it was going to ignore Alien 3 and 4, which is fine because those movies are bonkers anyways. But Prometheus 2 is where they're putting their money behind for Ridley Scott, because you know, the Alien and Prometheus movies do well for him. So I'm still looking forward to Prometheus 2. I know that a lot of people didn't like it, the first one, but gosh darn it, I thought it was a beautiful looking movie and some pretty cool stuff in that film. The last piece of news I want to talk about is something a bit dear to my heart, and that is Mystery Science Theater 3000 is attempting to come back from the dead. Now, for those who don't know what Mystery Science Theater is, it's also known as MST3K to us nerds out there. This was a TV show back in the 80s and 90s, started out in, I think, 1987 in KTMA, a small independent station in Minneapolis. The premise is there's this guy stuck on a satellite, and these mad scientists are sending him movies, and he sits there with his robot pals and makes fun of them. This is sort of really invented the riff culture, which, of course, was coming around anyways once you had VHS back in the 80s. I mean, the show started in 1987, so it wasn't very far after VHS started that you had somebody doing callbacks to movies. Because it's annoying if you're in a theater and people are doing this, but if you're at home with your friends and maybe enjoying a couple adult beverages, why not? Knock yourself out. Mystery Science Theater was on for 10 seasons, ran on KTMA, then on Comedy Channel, which then became Comedy Central, then got dumped off of that and went to Sci-Fi. Had a long career. Joel Hodgson, who created the show, he went through 4.5 seasons on Comedy Channel, Comedy Central, and then he left in the middle of season 5. Michael J. Nelson took over. And then after it got canceled, Michael J. Nelson knocked around a little bit, trying a couple different projects, and eventually settled on Riff Tracks, which has now become a huge thing. But if you look back at where Riff Tracks started, Riff Tracks was just Mike Nelson making fun of movies himself, and then finally brought in Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett, who had done the Sci-Fi Channel era shows. Anyways, Joel Hodgson, who created the show, and then eventually did projects like Cinematic Titanic, which was another riffing series, he is trying to bring back MST3K. He launched a Kickstarter campaign this week. And I'm overjoyed to see this show come back. I'm a little nervous, though. And I have to say, I have my reservations. I mean, I know there are people like, yes, MST3K, bring it back, bring it back, bring it back. But for me, there's a lot of unanswered questions here. Because, you know, they're just raising money at this point. A couple $1 million is what they need, and they're going to get it. But who's going to play Tom Servo and Crow? I mean, I'm sure he can get Trace Ballou to play Crow because they still are friends and they still get along, I think. Is Kevin Murphy going to come back and play Tom Servo? Or are they going to get Josh Weinstein, who originally played him? I'm a little nervous about that because to me, Tom Servo is Kevin Murphy and Kevin Murphy's doing Riff Trax. But I think there's been some bridges mended between Riff Trax and MST because now MST is being distributed. Some of their old episodes are being distributed by Riff Trax and there's a little bit of cross pollination and that's great. I think we need to get together because whenever you get a bunch of artists together or creative types, you're going to fight. And there were some rifts that were created, not rifts, but rifts between the people in this whole situation. Now it's a cult show and it's been off the air for more than 15 years. So it's now sort of has this legendary status. I'm looking forward to seeing it come back. Although I got to say, I just hope it's as fresh and as adorable and as Saturday morning programming as Joel originally made it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is Warcraft. This one dropped late last week.
If we do not unite, our world will perish.
This doesn't need to happen. There is one who may help us.
For orcs, there is no other life but war. No, but with the humans' help, there could be.
Why are you here?
To save our people.
They're beasts. They should all be destroyed.
Now, Warcraft is based on World of Warcraft, and I know there's a lot of people that are crazy excited for this. It looks very much like a Hobbit-type movie directed by somebody other than Peter Jackson. And I give him credit that at least it looks like one of the Tolkien movies, and it doesn't look like The Last Witch Hunter or Seventh Son. But I think the biggest struggle that Warcraft's going to have is reaching an audience who don't play World of Warcraft. And look, there's a lot of people who do, but that's not necessarily the mainstream. And if everybody who plays this goes out and watches the movie, it's probably going to be a success. But for it to be a Lord of the Rings level of success, a Harry Potter level of success, you got to reach the mainstream. And there aren't any recognizable faces. The closest one you can recognize is Paula Patton. And I don't know if she's a selling point. She's got these big tusks and everything. I mean, like Ron Perlman's in the movie, but you wouldn't know because I think he's all CGI generated mocap. But even then, Ron Perlman's not somebody who sells a movie. So this is an uphill battle. I think it looks cool and I'm going to look forward to seeing it. I think Jones does a great job as a director, but we'll see on June 10th when it opens. The next one I want to hit is My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2, opens on March 25th.
A long time ago, I had a big fat Greek wedding. But there's always...
The priest never signed the wedding license.
A few surprises.
We're not married!
Now, my family has come together.
Who says a woman has to be married?
You. All our lives.
The wedding is off!
To pull off another
beautiful
big fat Greek wedding.
I wasn't even aware they were making this movie. Does that make me out of touch? I don't know. If me not knowing the history of future projects by Nia Vardalos makes me out of touch, then maybe I'm out of touch. This movie looks terrible. My Big Fat Greek Wedding, the first one, was a charming little surprise sleeper hit. It was really cute. Then for the next 15 years, almost, essentially made absolute crap. She made movies like I Hate Valentine's Day, which is terrible, and My Life in Ruins, which is terrible, and Connie and Carla, which is terrible. And all these movies, they might have had a certain level of success, because I think like I Hate Valentine's Day did okay overseas, but none of these movies are massive hits. Then she like wrote Larry Crown with Tom Hanks. That one did okay. It made its money back, but it wasn't a big movie for what they are expecting with Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts. So don't just believe her Wikipedia page, which has been heavily edited in her favor. Every movie she's done since My Big Fat Greek Wedding has tanked in the reviews and generally hasn't done well in the box office. I watched it with my wife, the trailer, and I said to her, I go, that looks like a roasted turd. I mean, it looks terrible. I don't know. We'll see. It's going up against Batman versus Superman, so who knows? It might do well. That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Love the Coopers and Labyrinth of Lies. Because we can't go! Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's lead into the movie reviews. The first one I want to talk about is the Christmas movie, which is Love the Coopers. You know, it's holiday season now, and we passed Halloween. We've got Thanksgiving coming up, but that doesn't matter. They've got Santa Claus in the store. They got people going bonkers over Starbucks coffee. They've got all the decorations for Christmas already out, so why not have a Christmas movie? In Love the Coopers, the dysfunctional family Christmas rears its ugly head as a family deals with all their individual problems on Christmas Eve.
Ah, the holiday season.
Oh, yes!
This is Charlotte Cooper.
Merry Christmas, everyone!
She has one simple holiday wish.
This is the only time of the year when we're all together. I want everyone to have the memory of a perfect Christmas.
Time for comfort and joy. It's Christmas.
As if you can schedule happiness.
No matter what happens, we are family.
Hear, hear.
I am actually a fan of dysfunctional family Christmas movies. I love Christmas movies too. Don't get me wrong. I love Miracle on 34th Street. I love It's a Wonderful Life. I love Christmas Vacation. I love The Christmas Story. I also love the cynical side of Christmas as well. And this is produced by the same people who did The Family Stone, which came out about 10 years ago. And I love The Family Stone. It stole my heart. It really did. Cause I was a little bit grumpy about that movie. And then when I saw it, I was like, this is actually a fantastic film. Now, that one also stars Diane Keaton. She plays the mom in that one. She plays the mom in this one. It's not a sequel because, well, if you know what happens to her at the end of The Family Stone, it can't be a sequel unless she's a zombie. So this movie is a whole different story. Diane Keaton and John Goodman play husband and wife, but they're the grandparents of the family, and they're on the splits. They're getting ready to split up and separate, and they want to have one last Christmas with their family. But of course, their kids are struggling with issues. Olivia Wilde plays the daughter who's kind of can't settle down and has all this dysfunction in her life from relationships, and she basically gets this guy to pretend to be her boyfriend, while Ed Helms is the one that did get married and have kids, and he's had a divorce with his wife, and he's dealing with his kids, and then the grandfather, played by Alan Arkin, is sort of having a melancholy friendship relationship with Amanda Seyfried, who works in a diner. One of the problems with this movie, though, it's got the weirdest casting. They have Marissa Tomei playing Diane Keaton's sister. And I mean, we're not talking about one of these things where, you know, like Diane Keaton in the movie Father of the Bride 2, where she accidentally got pregnant in her 50s, for example. No. She's honest to God, their sister. They have flashbacks to them where they're, 4 or 5 years apart? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I looked it up. Diane Keaton's 19 years older than Marissa Tomei. And look, Diane Keaton is a beautiful woman, and she always was, but she's like almost 70. Marissa Tomei is 50. I really feel bad for Marissa Tomei. Are they trying to tell us that at 50 years old? I mean, she's only a couple years older than Ed Helms, who plays Diane Keaton's son. I mean, Marissa Tomei doesn't look like she's 25 anymore, but she certainly doesn't look like she's ready for an AARP card. She still looks great for 50. So I thought that was almost insulting to Marissa Tomei. I felt so bad. This is an Oscar winner. I don't know whether they're trying to say Marissa Tomei is that much older than she really is, or Diane Keaton's that much younger. The problems that this movie faces is it does tend to be overwritten at times. It has this interesting framework of a narrator that you don't find out who the narrator is until the end of the film. And it's an interesting framework, and it allows them to do some more surreal moments and some more different moments. It has some really out-of-the-box presentation. at times where they're sort of having flashbacks within the scene. And it does kind of go a little high concept in terms of the narrative and the storytelling. But at times it's really heavy handed. For example, there's a scene where Olivia Wilde's character flashes back to something and you see her turn to glass and shatter. And then the narrator said, and that shattered her. And I'm like, well, you just ruined that beautiful moment in the film because you had to explain to somebody that you were using metaphor. I mean, the amount of stupidity that Hollywood puts on its audience is staggering. But still, the characters are not always the best written characters. And they fall into cliche and they fall into... A great example, Olivia Wilde, she meets this guy at an airport and she's like, can you just come home and pretend to be my boyfriend? And the guy's going off to be in the army and he's getting ready to be deployed. And so they make it that he's a Republican and she's apparently come from a liberal family. But it's such an awkward statement of politics in this movie at this point. And it rings to the thing where Hollywood makes movies. And a lot of times, obviously everybody knows in Hollywood, not everybody, but a lot of people are liberal. It's okay to be liberal in Hollywood. It's not okay to be conservative in Hollywood. A lot of times these movies will present politics as if, well, there are these weirdos from flyover country, because it takes place in Pittsburgh. There's these weirdos from flyover country who are Republicans, but, you know, they're conservative, but they're weird and normal people are liberal. And they go into these weird political moments that have no business in this movie because it's not a political movie. Look, I mean, a movie like Truth or Michael Moore's new movie. Yeah. Politics all over the place in a movie like that because they're steeped in politics. This one's not. It's sort of like when you're at the water cooler at work and you get these obnoxious people, and they're going to be liberal or conservative, whoever would say this, and they start just spouting off their views, assuming everyone agrees with them. And because people don't want to get into a big argument because they become a jerk about it, they assume everyone just agrees with them, and they really aren't. And it's kind of obnoxiously written at times. But ultimately, the movie itself doesn't hold together, and it has a couple laughs, but it's sort of like it's not quite there. It's very half-baked. So I'm going to have to say Love the Coopers kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Labyrinth of Lies. I don't have a trailer for this because it's in German. And you wouldn't understand it anyways. And generally, radio stations don't like to just broadcast stuff in other languages without knowing what they're saying first. So in this film, an eager young prosecutor in West Germany decides to prosecute the Nazis who committed heinous acts at Auschwitz. This is one of those movies where it's the country itself, because it was a German film, working through its guilt about World War II and about the Nazis and what happened during the Holocaust. And I think it's fascinating because, you know, it takes place in the early 60s where there was a lot of people just saying, well, we're not going to talk about what happened during World War II. And yeah, we got these people who did some horrible things, but let's, you know, just let them go, let them live their lives. And there are people that had to stand up and say, no, you didn't just participate in a war. You turned into sadists at time. You did horrible, horrible things and war crimes, and you need to be prosecuted. And it's a necessary movie. It's something that people need to see because it shows how this stuff was almost swept under the rug in post-war Germany. And this shows the struggle that Germany had to deal with in reconciling World War II and the atrocities that happened there. It's a well-done movie. It was submitted as Germany's bid for the Oscar last year. You know, it's a good film. It's well done. It runs a bit long and it has this love story that's really forced in there and it doesn't quite work, but I guess people will do this when they make movies. They're like, well, we gotta have a love story or women won't come see it. And so it just doesn't work in that respect, but that's the way the movie is. I mean, it's a fascinating film, totally worth seeing, especially if you want to look at the history of World War II and Germany dealing with their problems. So I'm going to have to say that Labyrinth of Lies, even though it's not a sequel to Labyrinth, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The 33. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing with the movie reviews. Well, let's continue the theme of true stories. And the first one I'm going to talk about is The 33. This docudrama tells the story of 33 Chilean miners trapped for months in a mine collapse and the rescue effort to free them.
A serious accident just occurred at the San Jose mine.
Say something, I'm giving up on you.
That's a big rock.
That's not a rock. That's the heart of the mountain. She finally broke.
And I...
33 men trapped underground. And we don't even know if they're alive.
We all know how this goes. The government tells us how much they care, and they do nothing.
Was over my head.
How long do they have?
There's food and water for 3 days.
This is probably the most exposure Chile has had on the movie screen since Eli Roth started making movies with his new girlfriend. First of all, it's better than Aftershock, which was the last movie that I saw that was heavily based in Chile. That doesn't mean it's a great movie. This is a great story. And everyone remembers this was about 5 years ago. These miners were down in the depth of this gold mine, and there was a cave-in, and a giant rock, like massive, like twice the size of the Empire State Building, crashed and locked them in. And there was this huge international effort to try and get them out, which is ironic. No one ever points out the irony of the fact that they were cutting some corners to, in terms of safety, to make this work. And it ended up costing everybody a lot more than what it would have cost if they would have just done this safely. And we all watched this unfold on the news. And so, I mean, you don't have to go very far to find out what really happened in the true story. This film actually has a decent cast. I mean, you've got like Antonio Banderas, who's good, and Lou Diamond Phillips, who's good, and Juliette Binoche, a French woman playing a Chilean woman, and other people like Bob Gunton, who's playing the president of Chile. The film tells a great story, but it doesn't really work on screen. This movie feels like a giant TV movie with a pretty big budget, but it just still feels like a TV movie. There is so much hand-wringing going on in this film. Not just with the miners when they're trapped down there, but with the families up top and the politics and the mining company and everybody involved. It really lays it on thick, and it's heavy. And I had to watch another family member, you know, moaning and groaning because they're... And this is not to diminish the people who had to go through this, but this is the way they're portrayed on screen. As a movie, the characters in the movie were just so morose and wrapped up in the drama. And this isn't like Apollo 13. Apollo 13 was about a disaster, and you're just like, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And you may know what happened at the end of Apollo 13, but it's sort of thrilling to watch. But this movie is, well, we're just going to drill. And these people are going to be starving down there because they had like 3 days worth of food and they're down there for a couple months. As true as it's trying to be to the story, and as true as it's trying to be as the sequence of events, when there's finally contact made, I'm just like, I'm ready for this thing to be over. I felt like I was trapped in a mine for a couple months watching this film. It just kept going. Like I said, very inspirational story. And it really made an international incident and a lot of us felt connected to. But ultimately, it feels like a Hallmark movie with a big budget. It's not that good. I'm going to have to say that The 33 kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about My All-American. The story of college football phenom Freddie Steinmark is told in this film.
I made Iron Mark watch a season worth of film. You got his attention.
We got 200 players fighting for a spot on a 100-man roster.
Double time. Let's go.
Football doesn't build character, it eliminates the weak.
I'm offering you a scholarship to attend the University of Texas and play football.
Well, every other coach just thought I was too small to play.
I like the way you attack.
You will not regret giving me the chance, sir.
Give me my hand back now, son.
Sorry.
I was a bit vague on the blurb there. And this is the problem when you get a movie like this. If you know the story of Freddie Steinmark, there's no surprise. I mean, it's you can go to Wikipedia, type his name, and you're going to get his story. But what happens that makes it very significant in the story doesn't happen until, like, gosh, the last 20 or 30 minutes of the movie. So you're sitting through an hour and a half of this film, and if you know the story, you're waiting for the shoe to drop, so to speak. And the gist of it is, it's this kid who loved football when he was a kid and grew up, but wasn't very big, but was just so determined and good at what he did that he kind of became a football star for the Texas Longhorns, and then had some health issues. And I'm just going to kind of leave it at that. But whenever you have a movie like this that's trying to honor somebody, the temptation is to not show anything bad about this person, to not show any challenges or any struggles that they had or any ugliness to their character. But that's just not realistic. Everybody has ugliness to their character. Everybody has skeletons in their character closet. And I'm not saying that I just want to see the ugly side of everybody, but the problem in this movie, Freddie Steinmark he's a caricature. He is not a real person. It doesn't feel like it in the movie. I mean, he is. And this person existed, but the character is just kind of very vapid. There's nothing to him. He loves football, and football's everything about his life. And he's a good guy, clean cut. He's got a beautiful girlfriend, but it shows no depth of his character. There's nothing about him aside from, gosh, coach, I'm going to be the best football player ever. And that's not interesting to watch. I mean, if you're so into football that you want to see the inside baseball of it, you know, I know I'm mixing my metaphors there, but if you're so into football that that turns you on, great, watch it. And just watch kind of how the behind the scenes of a college team works. That's fine, but there's no depth to him. There's no complexity to the character being shown in the movie. I'm sure there was plenty of complexity to the real Freddie Steinmark, but not in what we get on screen. And it's corny, and it's cheesy, and it feels so false at times. And the other thing, and this is something that bothers me, and I remember I had a problem with this when I saw the movie Friday Night Lights, you know, like 10 years ago. There's an attitude, a prevailing attitude in this film that football is the most important thing, more important than your health. And I said this to my son who played a little bit of football. I said, the problem with like some people in sports medicine, and this isn't everybody, but there are people in sports medicine and coaches where they're not there to make you better. They're there to make you better enough to play. And they address that at one point in this movie, but it's a throwaway line. And there's times when I'm watching this going, you know, if Steinmark had gotten things looked at earlier, would things have been different? If he wasn't so stubborn and decided to defy his doctors, would things have been different? And there's a certain point where you're saying, oh, it's brave for him to work through the pain and shake it off. But is that the smartest thing to do? And is that the role model you want to have? Because you neglect something and it can get really bad. And that's one of the reasons I don't like this movie. That's one of my issues with sports in general, especially high school and college sports, because the sport's more important sometimes than the players. And I think that pervades this movie. And that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is it's just kind of boring. If you want to read a good biography of somebody, you go read a professionally written adult biography. You know, something that you go to the library and it's a thick book. And this reminded me of like World Book Encyclopedia would do for like third graders. And they're written very Mickey Mouse and they're very high level, and they're like, oh, he was just a charming lad. And they do that in this movie. It just makes everything so kind of picture perfect at times. And even then, what's weird about this, there's this weird anti-hippie element to this movie where all the football players are these clean-cut guys. And I mean, I can understand that in like 1962, but I mean, this was 1969 where some of the stuff's happening. And you're telling me nobody on the team had long hair or a mustache? No, just the guys protesting Vietnam that they walk past and have to get in a fight with. There's a scene in there where President Nixon comes to one of the games and they show the family back home in the living room when President Nixon shows up, they applaud. And I'm like, that was a weird, heavy-handed political statement. I mean, you know, you can like Nixon or not like Nixon, but that seemed weird for any president, really. I mean, maybe if it was that one that's always been revered and always remembered, somebody like JFK, it just seemed really odd. sort of like the people who made this movie had a certain view of what they thought the right kind of people were at the time and marginalized everybody else. So, I don't know. My All-American, while it's an honorable story, the movie sucked.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be doing one more review, The Funhouse Massacre, The Box Office, and, of course, The Home Cinema Roundup.
Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
With Fat Guys at the Movies, finishing up with the movie reviews, let's talk about The Funhouse Massacre. The daughter of a violent mental patient releases her father and others from maximum security, and they take over a haunted house exhibit on Halloween night.
Let's give the boys a tour of their new playground.
It looks like a killer scene tonight here at the Macon County Funhouse.
People are literally losing their heads to get in here tonight.
Let me guess, your friend's been murdered at the funhouse. Wow, that was actually pretty realistic.
Are you crazy? Do you know what's happening out there?
Oh, you mean the deranged serial killers who are pretending to be haunted house characters and killing everybody?
Look, I'll be the first to admit that this probably should have came out a couple weeks ago. It's a little odd having a horror movie that takes place on Halloween come out 2 weeks after Halloween. So I can question the release schedule of this one, but I understand what they're trying to do. I mean, Halloween's so busy, and there were other movies like Tales of Halloween and Extraordinary Tales, and there was enough stuff going on in October that I think they said, well, look, here's a Friday the 13th release date that we can take advantage of. And so, yeah, Friday the 13th is kind of cool. I mean, you always get one or two Friday the 13th each year, but you are dealing with it coming out closer to Thanksgiving than closer to Halloween. But still, this is just your basic horror film. Now, there's a lot of horror films. In fact, if you like horror movies, anyone out there who enjoys horror movies, especially if you're in like flyover country, if you're not in a major city like New York, LA, Chicago, or even Columbus, where it was just total flyover country, which is where I'm from, Columbus, Ohio, we have a theater in town called the Gateway Film Center, and they show a lot of horror movies and obscure, weird stuff throughout the year, which is great. And the Drexel, that's more art house. But the Gateway shows a lot of these movies over the year. Well, and this one actually is opening at an AMC theater in town. But these are movies that get released throughout the year. And if you really like horror movies, then you need to spend time on VOD services, because that's where the real innovative stuff's happening. Yeah, every now and then you get a movie like The Conjuring or Insidious. You see those every now and then in the theaters, but the real innovative stuff, the real cool stuff happens on demand. And that's where the coolest things in horror are, especially if you don't live in a place where you can get to a theater like the Gateway near me. Or if you're in New York or LA, that way you have a bunch of theaters that will play alternative things. The Funhouse Massacre it's a quintessential Halloween horror movie. It's your basic bunch of psycho killers getting together, attacking people, and being just generally uncomfortable to watch at times. It reminds me a little bit of Gravy, only instead of taking place in a Mexican restaurant, it takes place in a haunted house. In a haunted house, not a haunted house as in, you know, a house that actually has ghosts in it, a haunted house exhibit. And what was cool watching this movie is earlier this year, back right around Halloween, I took my sons, there's two amusement parks in Ohio that are really like premier well-done amusement parks. They're constantly topping the list with top roller coasters. They're great amusement parks. So one, Cedar Point, which is up by Lake Erie in the middle of the state, and then Kings Island, which is down by Cincinnati. And those are both easy to drive to, 2.5 hours away for me. And we got season passes to the whole shebang. and they had Halloweekends there where you could go up and they open up the park and it's has limited attractions. And they have some other rides, but they also have like a dozen haunted houses and haunted areas to walk through. And I took my kids there, and that was great because if you miss a haunted house in the main event of Halloween, you get to go see like 7 or 8 of them in one night. And it's a lot of fun because they have actors that'll jump out at you. And yeah, we had a blast going to these things and then seeing a movie like The Funhouse Massacre, which is essentially what it is. It's these actors in a haunted house who are then kidnapped and attacked by these mental patients. And then nobody realizes that they're really killing people in there because, you know, it's a haunted house. So you just think it's really good special effects. In fact, there's a scene in there where they're in a clown house where they're in one of those tunnels that spins around. And there was one exactly like that in this haunted house at Kings Island. And it was neat having gone through those for real. And then very soon afterwards to see a movie like this. So if you love that haunted house experience, that's the kind of movie this is. And yeah, it sort of revels in the gore and the attacks and the psycho killers attacking people. But, you know, hey, if you're into that sort of thing, it opens, you know, it's a Friday the 13th weekend release. And I think it'll play well around Halloween again. You just got to have to wait a year for that to happen. But the Funhouse Massacre's fun. It's a bloody good time, we'll say. So, yeah, I'm going to have to say the Funhouse Massacre kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Now, last week, this is interesting. Last week, I said $72 million for Spectre. And people were saying, oh, no, Kevin Carr, you're dumb. That's not going to happen. It's going to make in the 80s. Maybe it is even going to top Skyfall. I knew it wasn't going to top Skyfall. I said $72 million, which is right on top of what they were predicting several weeks ago before sort of the hype started up leading up to the release. And when the numbers came in on Sunday for the estimates, it was like 72, 73 million. I was right on the nose with the estimates. When the final actuals came in, it was just over 70 million. So the estimate was just a hair above, like by 2%. I was right. I was right on the nose. And in fact, I actually overestimated a little bit. I think that if it had gone in under 70 million, if it would have been like 69, I mean, even if it made like half a million less and was like $69.9 million, it would have been seen as a disappointment because everyone was expecting Spectre to be like Skyfall. Skyfall was an aberration. You're not going to get that again unless you run the series into the ground and completely overdevelop the character to the point of ad nauseum. Spectre works as a perfectly fine James Bond flick, and they spent a lot of money on it, but then again, they also probably got a pretty penny in merchandising deals with, like, Aston Martin and all the different product placement. That's always what's funded James Bond movies in the past, is I think Tomorrow Never Dies, they spent $10 million on it that they didn't get covered with product placement. Something like that. It was like a $150 million budget, and they got like $135 or $140 million in product placement. So that's what funds these movies, and they want to, they're going to make money back. They've already made their money back. It's over $300 million worldwide. This is still going to be a hit. It's not going to be the $1 billion worldwide, unless it just keeps going great guns overseas. But the problem is, you've got a lot of competition coming up with the Hunger Games, and then later on you're going to have Star Wars, but that's a month down the line. But still, it's not going to top Skyfall. So I was right on the nose. Now this week, I'm going to say $35 million for Spectre. And the reason is, it's going to do better than some people are predicting, like $30 million or less. I don't think it's going to drop that much, mainly because it's got no competition out there. It was the 33 and Love the Coopers and My All American, which are all the new releases this week in terms of wide releases. Those aren't going to take any audience away from Spectre. This gets a week of secondary play before it has to go up against Mockingjay next week. So that's my prediction. $35 million for Spectre, and right on its tails is going to be the Peanuts movie, which I think is going to hold better. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Terminator Genesis is the big one for this week, and I like this movie. I liked it in spite of Jai Courtney being in it, because I think he's terrible. And he's sort of like Sam Worthington, where he had like one thing that did well. And I don't even think Jai Courtney has anything that does well. I mean, there are movies that do well in spite of him, like the Divergent movies. Nobody's seeing it for him. But the movies he's headlined, stuff like Die Hard 5 or or Jack Reacher, where he's the bad guy in Jack Reacher. I mean, these movies do well in spite of him. Sam Worthington was in two movies that did very, very well. Obviously, Avatar and then Clash of the Titans. And then everything else, nobody cares about these guys. Nobody cares about these actors. These actors have a good resume, but they have no oomph behind them as actual actors to put on a movie poster. But still, Terminator Genisys is a lot of fun because you get Arnold Schwarzenegger back, and it's a fun Terminator movie. It's just, it's a time travel movie, and that's challenging for some people, not for me, but then again, I watch a lot of time travel movies. Better Call Saul, season one, that is out on DVD. That is the prequel to Breaking Bad. I've not watched it, actually. I watched Breaking Bad this summer, so now I got to watch Better Call Saul. I got to catch up on that before the new season starts. A couple other seasons of 80s cheese. You've got Manimal, the complete series, and Automan, the complete series. These were really corny TV series from the 80s that I personally, I loved Manimal, even though it was awful, about a guy who turns into, like, cats and, I mean, like leopards and or he turns into a panther. He's not like the fancy feast cat from the television. And then there's also Mr. Holmes, which is Ian McKellen as Sherlock Holmes later in life. Selfless, which stars Ben Kingsley as a man who gets a new body in Ryan Reynolds and sort of has to reconcile the body's past. And there's also Trainwreck, which I was not a fan of, but I know a lot of people like that, with Amy Schumer. And then Bound to Vengeance, which I covered about 6 months ago on the show. It is now out on DVD and Blu-ray. That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 2, or what should have been edited into last year's release, The Night Before, and The Secret in Their Eyes. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.